This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Tonight, Utah will try to reverse the direction in which the NBA's Western Conference Finals have been going. The Jazz, off-key and not sufficiently improvisational to this point, will host the San Antonio Spurs, who lead that series 2-0. Tomorrow, the Cavaliers will face a similar challenge. The Pistons, less polite and, well, less cavalier, won the first 2 games of the Eastern Conference Finals in Detroit, and they will attempt to maintain the momentum in Cleveland. If, when you imagine teams contending fiercely for a championship, you are inclined to think in terms of raging animals such as tigers, bears, bulls, or perhaps raptors, or maybe equally violent entities like storms, hurricanes, or fire, you'll perhaps be underwhelmed to learn that when the Stanley Cup Finals begin on Monday, the Senators will face off against the Ducks. But whether by boring the opposition into a stupor or playing solid hockey, the Ottawa Senators have made the finals for the first time. The previously mighty Ducks, now mere Ducks and nothing more, have been there once before. Joining me now to handicap the series is Helene Elliott of the LA Times. Welcome back to Only a Game, Helene.
Thanks so much.
The Stanley Cup Finals begin on Monday, even though the Ottawa Senators sent Buffalo packing last Saturday and the Anaheim Ducks sent the Red Wings to the golf courses on Tuesday. What is the league's rationale for the long wait before the finals begin?
You're assuming the NHL has a rationale behind
it? I'm sorry. How foolish of me. Silly
me.
Goodness
gracious. Shame on you. Well, it would have started sooner. I think we probably would have started Saturday if the folks who run the Honda Center in Anaheim had not booked the Champions on Ice figure skating show to be in the building on Saturday.
This tells us something about priorities, doesn't it?
Doesn't it, though? I guess somebody there didn't think that the little duckies would make it to the Stanley Cup Finals.
The Ottawa Senators have endured many disappointing postseasons before reaching the finals. Tell me a little bit about this team and how it came to the brink of what would be its first NHL title.
Yeah, it's been interesting because the last few seasons, Ottawa has had great regular seasons and then has been a flop in the playoffs. This season, they had a terrible start. People were saying, well, maybe the coach should be fired. Maybe, you know, they need major changes. Maybe they need an overhaul. And here they are in the Cup Finals. I think this team is a little bit tougher maybe than the previous Senators teams. And the expectations were lower, and I think that helped. And they just went out and played and didn't listen to the many critics who pop out of the woodwork in Canada and other places when the team didn't play well, and they've had a terrific season.
Toronto, Montreal, and Edmonton missed the playoffs this year. Calgary and Vancouver made the postseason, but they're gone now. Is Canada rallying behind the Senators?
That's a good question, and I think that once they get to the final, yeah, people in Canada will, their pride will kick in and they will adopt the Senators as a matter of pride. And, you know, the Canadian team has not won the Stanley Cup since 1993. And this will be a big thing for them, you know, keeping it away from us heathen south of the border.
Speaking of hockey and nationalism, it was announced this week that the Nashville Predators will be sold to Canadian businessman Jim Balsillie, who made an unsuccessful offer to purchase the Penguins last year. Why hasn't the Preds' recent success translated into ticket sales and revenue streams for current ownership?
I think part of the problem is that the Predators were a novelty during their first few seasons in Nashville. They got a lot of country music stars at the games, and things were actually going pretty well. But I think, like a lot of teams, they suffered from the lockout. You know, fans kind of forgot about them for a little while. The attendance has been declining. The team hasn't gone far in the playoffs. So I think fans have kind of lost interest a little bit. I don't think there's the corporate base that a lot of teams need and like when they try to fill their suites. So I think that the Predators will be out of Music City very soon.
Well, do you anticipate that they will be Canada's next team? And if so, where are they bound?
That's a good question. And it really would signal a huge, huge moment in the NHL if they were to move to Canada or pretty much anywhere outside the Sun Belt. It would kind of represent an acknowledgement that, you know what, the Sun Belt stuff may not be working. And if they do move, I think that it could signal the start of a mass migration.
Okay, back to good old American hockey. The Anaheim Ducks, formerly the Mighty Ducks, have also never won at all. This is their second trip to the finals. Is Southern California even aware that the Ducks are vying for a championship?
a little bit of a buzz here, not huge, but I think there is. I think that having played the Detroit Red Wings was good for them in terms of there seemed to be a lot of Red Wing fans outside of Detroit, and creating some little bit of swell in terms of TV ratings and awareness, at least, anyway. Big events tend to get lost here. There's just so many teams. It's just such a big area. You know, the Dodgers are always going to be number one, and you've got the Angels going, and there's so much to do around here. But I think there is a little bit of a groundswell of interest here.
Any particular members of the Ducks we should be watching in this series?
I think the key is how Jean-Sébastien Jaguar plays in goal. I think Ottawa's got a terrific offense. Their number one line is a trio that the Ducks have not seen anything like, Heatley and Spezza and Alfredsson. They're quick, they're fast, they're big. The Ducks have not faced anybody like them, and it'll be interesting to see how the Ducks handle that. But I think the great equalizer is good goaltending, and Jean-Sébastien Jaguar certainly can provide that and better.
Okay, Helene, our horse racing expert, Jenny Reese, got the Kentucky Derby right this year. Oh. So the pressure's on. Who wins this thing?
You know what? I'm retiring from the prediction business because I picked Florida to manhandle UCLA in the NCAA Final Four, and they did. And I predicted that the Ducks would beat Detroit, and that generated a lot of very, very nasty emails sent my way. I think I'm going to sit this one out and just say that thanks to the unbalanced schedule forced it upon us by Gary Bettman, we haven't seen Ottawa in such a long time that it's just impossible to pick.
Helene Elliott writes about pro hockey for the LA Times, and she chronicles the annual quest for Sir Frederick's Flagon, otherwise known as the Stanley Cup, for only a game. Helene, thanks again, and have a great offseason.
Thank you.
One of the unexpected stories of this year's baseball season has the Milwaukee Brewers well atop the National League Central Division. The Brewers are winning with a mix of veterans and younger players who grew up in the game, and the roof of their new ballpark isn't even leaking as much as it used to. But will these delights save Milwaukee baseball fans from the usual mid-season deluge of pessimism? Wisconsin Public Radio's Chuck Kornbach reports.
The Brewers haven't had a winning season since 1992, when future Hall of Famers Robin Yount and Paul Molitor were in Milwaukee uniforms. Only 5 years ago, the team lost more than 100 games. The new roof at Miller Park was leaking, and many wanted Bud Selig and family to sell the franchise. Well, in 2005, the Selig sellers got their wish. The roof doesn't leak as much, and the Brewers have excited a lot of people, including Telemundo baseball announcer Hector Molina. Some of the Brewers' early season stars include players with familiar baseball names. First baseman Prince Fielder not only pounds the ball hard during batting practice, he's among the league leaders in home runs. His father, Cecil, was a Tigers slugger in the 1990s. Fielder the younger insists he's not trying to outdo his dad.
No, I mean, I just want to win, you know. It has nothing to do with my dad, you know. It's just me, you know, my profession, and, you know, you want to be known as a winner, so, you know, it's always good to be on a winning team.
Brewers outfielder Tony Gwynn Jr. has been playing more of late and is batting over 300, just as his dad, Tony Gwynn, did for many years as a San Diego Padre. But the younger Gwynn says his father only played in two World Series.
I don't really think my dad's success has anything to do with it because, in all honesty, he only played for a couple winning teams in his 19 years. So, you know, I'm just blessed to have the opportunity to be a part of a winning team so far. Hopefully we can keep it going the rest of the year.
Some of the Brewers' older players also have a baseball lineage. Infielder Craig Counsell has helped Milwaukee's defense, the same way his glove helped the Florida Marlins win the World Series in 1997 and the Arizona Diamondbacks win the 2001 Fall Classic. After leaving Arizona last year, Counsell wanted to come back to Milwaukee. He's played here before and grew up here in the early 1980s when his dad was a front office employee and the Brewers were a consistent winner.
You know, you remember kind of how the city was back then and how excited everybody got. So to be able to hopefully be a part of that is, you know, it's a kind of a dream of yours for sure.
But family memories don't win games. Among other things, you need good pitching, and pitching depth was a question mark before the season began. So the Brewers spent millions of dollars to bring in starter Jeff Supan, who picked up a World Series ring last year with St. Louis. Supan is among the top winners in the league and says he's very happy with his choice of Milwaukee.
You know, that you see it's a very talented team, but what struck me is that they're very hardworking and they're focused, and I think that's the key. That's what I like to see.
Another veteran leader almost wasn't with the Brewers this year. The club nearly dumped highly paid outfielder Jeff Jenkins, but he's batting close to 300 and last Sunday knocked in 5 runs to help the Brewers end a 2-game losing streak. Jenkins tries to shrug off last winter's uncertainty.
You know, I think once we got to spring training, all that kind of went away, and it was time to get down to business and just playing baseball and get back to winning games. And, you know, it's been a great start to the season.
Earlier this decade, when the Brewers played terrible baseball, the fans still came out to see the new baseball park or the popular seventh-inning promotion involving racing sausages. Now they're here to see winning baseball and to buy Brewers souvenirs. Gwen White picked up some things for her young grandson during last Saturday's game.
I bought him a sausage, and I bought him a size 3 Brewer t-shirt. And he has a cheesehead hat and a Brewer baseball that talks.
White says she's excited about the team, too.
Because it'd be nice to have the Brewers take it all again.
Well, the Brewers have never taken it all, unless you count the 1982 American League pennant. Amid his Sunday noon tailgating, Steve Barr said his optimism has limits.
Well, it is guarded because I think all of us Wisconsin sports fans have, you know, we're scared.
A slump over the last 2 weeks has pushed the Brewers back closer to 500 and occasionally made manager Ned Yost tense. After one loss, he admitted to considering some lineup changes.
When it's ready, when I'm ready, when it's right, I'll look at it. I'm thinking about it. I'm not doing anything right now.
This season in Milwaukee, 25 years after the Brewers' only World Series appearance, and 50 years after the Braves became Milwaukee's only World Series champs, there's hope that Ned Yost and the 2007 Brewers will do whatever it takes to succeed. For Only a Game, I'm Chuck Fernbach in Milwaukee.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, an unlikely friendship between the Georgia Peach and the Sultan of Swat. But first, testimony in the trial de Landis is finally complete, but it will likely be weeks, if not months, before we know if Floyd Landis will be considered the winner of the 2006 Tour de France. Lawyers for Landis say the rider's positive tests for synthetic testosterone during last year's tour were the result of shoddy lab practices and a failure to follow proper procedure. The U.S. Anti-Doping Agency says Landis is a cheat and should be banned for 2 years. The hearing was held in full view of the public and ESPN senior writer Sean Assale at the Pepperdine School of Law in Southern California. Sean Assale joins me now. Sean, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hey, thank you, Bill.
I'd always assumed that these sorts of things are all about lab tests and security measures, but the line of questioning in this hearing covered everything from abuse Greg LeMond suffered in his childhood to Landis's choice of ties. Was this to be expected?
This is not the case that Floyd Landis expected when he rented out an auditorium at Pepperdine and thought he would be the first one to put drug testing on trial. Floyd thought that as a Mennonite, he could use his character as his defense and put the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency on defense. And I think you saw why USADA has an unbeaten record in these kinds of cases.
USADA hearings are usually closed to the public. As you say, Landis lobbied hard for an open hearing, hoping to gain the public's sympathy. It is safe to say, I suppose, after Greg LeMond's testimony, that it really didn't work out the way Landis had hoped it would.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, could you imagine a stupider thing than calling a witness on the eve of trial and then trying to intimidate him? I can't imagine what they were thinking. And, you know, it's not even the crime. It's always these things. It's the attempt at the cover-up. And on the stand the next day, you heard Floyd saying, well, it turned out he was in the room when the call was made. And, you know, even though his attorney fired this manager in the middle of court with people looking on, Floyd had to explain why it took a couple of days for that to happen. Disaster, Bill.
The crux of LeMond's testimony was meant to be his claim that Landis admitted doping in a private phone call after his test results were leaked. Attorneys for Landis tried to paint LeMond as a jealous man who has tried to destroy the reputations of the only other American Tour de France winners. Is it suspect that LeMond claims both Lance Armstrong and Floyd Landis admitted doping to him in private, whereas neither has done so in public?
Yeah, I don't know what to believe. All I can say is that LeMond's testimony was supposed to be just simply a little piece of the puzzle, something that USADA would use in the concert with this broader scientific evidence, something that, you know, the Landis people would, as you say, try to poke holes in, showing that he had said roughly the same thing about Lance. Isn't it suspect that these two statements are so similar? It should have been an in-and-out morning, and instead it wound up defining this entire trial.
Ultimately, this case is likely to come down to testing practices and whether they are fair, controlled, and dependable, but the testimony related to that very important question has gotten very little attention, relatively. Did either side make its case well in terms of the science?
You know, it's hard to say. I think USADA made its case better, and it made the case it had to make. I think that the Landis people made a peripheral case, which is to say that, yes, the lab had some shoddy practices. Yes, there should be better controls. And yes, isn't it unfortunate that there's not more transparency? But ultimately, these are peripheral issues that would make, if dealt with, the doping system better. But they didn't ultimately go to the narrow issue of whether the tests showed synthetic testosterone. And I think on points, USADA won that round.
The Landis camp estimates that they will spend $2 million on Floyd Landis's defense. $750,000 has been raised in an old-fashioned barnstorming tour called the Floyd Fairness Fund. How must people who contributed to that cause be feeling at this point?
Well, it's interesting that you say that because I wrote a piece for ESPN.com on that very issue in which I called around to several of the people who had donated to the fund. And, you know, they believe in Floyd, but you could tell their breath was taken away by this. I think a lot of people aren't going to be able to endorse Floyd as a victim here as much as they once did. Having said that, I think a lot of them contributed to put the system on trial, and they may have felt their money was at least well spent in that regard.
While we have been paying attention to Floyd Landis in this country, in Europe, current and former telecom team riders have been publicly admitting their use of the blood doping agent EPO, including 1996 Tour winner Bjarne Riis. Riis told a PAC news conference yesterday that his yellow jersey is right at home in a cardboard box and the tour organizers are welcome to come pick it up. Can we expect more revelations like this?
You know, Bill, it's so interesting because what you see happening in cycling right now is precisely what you do not see happening in baseball. In baseball, this wall of silence continues unpierced. And I think in cycling, you're now seeing people realizing that it's just, you know, one allegation after another is going to come tumbling out, get ahead of the curve. And I think that's what you're seeing this week, and I think you're going to continue to see it. It's going to be a snowball effect.
Sean Assale is a senior writer for ESPN, the magazine, and he's an expert in all things doping. Sean, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks, Bill.
Ty Cobb, voted by the sports writers of his heyday the greatest of all baseball players, is remembered as a feisty battler who would do anything it took to win on the ball field and ended his life as an erratic and irascible alcoholic. Babe Ruth, always a fan favorite, was known for his colossal home runs and his outsized lifestyle. In Ty and the Babe, subtitled Baseball's Fiercest Rivals, A Surprising Friendship, and the 1941 Has-Beens Golf Championship, Tom Stanton examines the relationship between the two great players during and after their baseball careers. Tom Stanton joins me now in the studio. Welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Bill.
When Ruth and Cobb were still active players, nobody was describing their relationship as a friendship. What did they have against each other?
Cobb was the master of the dead ball era. He was king of the sport when Ruth emerged in 1914 with the Red Sox and then faced Cobb for the first time in 1915. Cobb was 28 years old, had won the American League batting title 8 years straight, had all the big endorsement deals, and along comes Ruth, who a few seasons later would begin to change the game and introduce into it, the popularity of the home run, and then it just kind of revolutionized the sport. And so what did they have against each other? Well, in Cobb's case, it was that somebody was altering the game the way it was played and stealing the spotlight from him. In Ruth's case, I guess what he had against Cobb was the way Cobb treated him, because Cobb was a psychological warrior. And he picked at Ruth. He learned early on that there was this embarrassing moment in Ruth's career when he was first a rookie with the Red Sox, where after playing ferociously on the field one day after coming back in the locker room, took a shower, and then returned to his original sweaty underwear and T-shirt. And Cobb took that tidbit and ran with it for the next 8-10 years. Every time he'd pass Ruth, he'd make a reference to a smell, or he'd clear his throat, or kick at the sand. And it, as you can imagine, it began to irritate Babe.
Cobb worked at baseball. You mention a game during which he sprinted to the bleachers, quote, to take testimony from 11 police officers in the stands to contest a call that an umpire had made. Is it fair to say that Ruth, on the other hand, played baseball?
That's very fair to say. Cobb was meticulous. He believed that you were hurting your baseball eyes if you had coffee with both cream and sugar. You could have coffee with the cream or coffee with the sugar, but you couldn't do both. And once he got something like that in his mind, he was very fervent in terms of following those things. And Ruth, you know, he played the game, and he probably had more fun than Cobb did as well.
Yeah, Ruth believed that you would hurt your batting eye if you had more than 11,000 beers in a week. Otherwise, everything was okay.
Yeah, I think that's part of what pricked Cobb about Ruth, is that he could play so well and yet let other parts of his life slide.
You specify that the 1925 World Series was an occasion when Ruth and Cobb moved toward actual friendship. What were the circumstances that made that possible?
You know, there were a few factors. I think a lot had to do with people surrounding them. They were both friends of Grantland Rice, the sports writer, and I think he was an influence toward bringing them together. There was Christy Walsh, who was the famous agent of Ruth and also of Cobb for a short while. And in the 24 series, he had conspired to get the two of them to share a taxi ride to the ballpark in Washington. The old rivalry started to melt a little bit then. But mostly, I think, in addition to those two folks, it was somebody that Ruth was having a relationship with, Claire Hodgson. She had grown up in the South, and her father was an attorney who had represented Ty Cobb. And way back before she had met Babe, who was married at the time, she had dated Ty Cobb. And I think it was kind of interesting that these two great rivals actually, at different points, were involved with the same woman.
This is the sort of circumstance that could go either way. I mean, you're saying it was part of what drew them together, but
I think it was more Claire's doing, trying to convince Babe, perhaps, that he wasn't such a bad guy. And another key thing, though, was I think Cobb had started to respect Ruth and to see that he was not just a one-dimensional ball player.
Most of our listeners probably think of Ty Cobb as a sociopath or worse. And in Ty and the Babe, you maintain that this characterization is utterly unfair. How so?
It's a caricature. It's a stereotype, and it's just become more shined as the years pass. Cobb was a multidimensional person. Many people think he, for example, had no friends. This guy had friends in baseball, actually. Of his peers at the time, Tris Speaker, Joe Jackson. I mean, he used to play poker frequently with Walter Johnson. He'd go hunting with Eddie Collins. He had friends in the game, and so that's one of the... For example, I talked with Ernie Harwell, who was a longtime Tiger broadcaster, and he had met both of the men and asked him who he'd rather spend an hour with. He said, without any hesitation, Ty Cobb. He found Ruth very blustery, sometimes belligerent, and Cobb was he was a sophisticated, articulate man who could be a real Southern gentleman. You often hear the comparison of the two funerals, that when Babe Ruth died, all of New York turned out, the city stopped, everybody came to Yankee Stadium, and then you hear on the other hand that when Cobb died, his funeral in Royston, there were only three baseball players who attended. It's kind of unfair to bring it up that way. If they'd held Cobb's funeral at Tiger Stadium, there would have been tens of thousands of people, but his family wanted a small affair, and most of his friends were gone by that point anyway.
In 1941, long after Cobb and Ruth had retired, they played a best 2 out of 3 golf match against each other. This is something I never knew until I read your book. Neither of these guys was all that great a golfer. Why did so many people care so much who won?
You know, both of them have been out of the spotlight. You had these two fading titans who were going to go at it once again. And for fans who had remembered their rivalry on the field, which, you know, stretched through parts of 14 seasons, for fans who remembered how vicious and how serious and that was in the sport, there was an appeal to this tournament. And Cobb had proposed it in 1939 when both of them were at the Hall of Fame induction ceremony. Mm-hmm. He passed a note to Ruth challenging him, and Ruth had arranged for a game to be played within 2 days because Cobb was taking his family to New York, but Cobb backed out, realizing that he hadn't prepared for this. And, you know, it would be another 2 years before it happened. And finally they did it. It was a three-leg tournament.
Three-legged tournament, and Cobb eventually won it by winning the third of the matches. Is it fair to say that winning the golf match was more important to Ty Cobb than it was to Babe Ruth?
Probably it was. But it's interesting in that I think it was also important to Ty Cobb. I found evidence of him checking his normal tense behavior to try to maintain a friendship, because I think by that point he really cherished Babe Ruth.
Tom Stanton is the author of Ty and the Babe, Baseball's Fiercest Rivals, A Surprising Friendship, and the 1941 Has-Beens Golf Championship, published by St. Martin's Press. Tom, thanks very much for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me, Bill.
But hey, Ty Cobb, we remember you. And sometimes the people we recognize most in history were just rotten through and through. Hey, Ty Cobb, we remember you. Hey, Ty Cobb, we remember you.
You're listening to Only a Game. Only a Game's Karen Given, whose story about commuting to work by bicycle with David Watson ran in last week's program, has acquired a lot of new best friends. Wow, wrote Phil Hammerslaw of Burlington, Vermont, a full 10 minutes on bicycle commuting. The guided commute was unique and would be a great way to get more people commuting by bicycle. Thanks for making my Saturday morning. Now I have to get out for a ride. Thank you, thank you, thank you, emailed Polly Henniger, who hears the program on WYPR in Baltimore. I commute to work in downtown Baltimore and run into all the situations in your story. David Watson's descriptions of how to position yourself in traffic were right on, as was his statement about cyclists respecting motorists. I always find something to enjoy on your show, but this story was over the top. Diana Osborne, who hears Only a Game on Vermont Public Radio, was among those disturbed by my discussion of APA, the record-setting Sherpa, with Charlie Pierce in last week's program. APA has reached the summit of Mount Everest 17 times. I love it that you go beyond the scores and into less commonly broadcast activities and athletes, Ms. Osborne wrote, but jokes about APA wearing sandals and picking up trash get real. This is a professional mountaineer with a dedicated spirit and fitness level that should be envied the world over. Are you trying to perpetuate the stereotype that sportscasters are shallow and uninformed? Finally, Alice Lisak, whose real name may be Emily Letella, and who hears the show on WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, and WAMC in Albany, New York, emailed that she was surprised to hear us talking last week about the Cleveland Cavs, C-A-L-V-E-S. After all, she wrote, cows are not exactly fearsome or fast or graceful. In fact, calves are pretty gangly and trip over their own legs a lot. So it was a great relief to hear somewhere in the course of the conversation that the team is actually the Cleveland Cavaliers, or C-A-V-S, rather than C-A-L-V-E-S. Thanks for providing an entertaining program that makes my Saturday morning commute more enjoyable. You can write us with your kudos, complaints, or never minds at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org, or leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Indigene Pharmaceuticals, maker of Relaxane, a non-prescription product for relieving the symptoms of everyday stress. Available at Rite Aid, GNC, and Duane Reade. This is NPR.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, casting for distance and accuracy rather than fish. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The Indy 500 takes place tomorrow, and I think the question on everybody's mind is the following. When will Marty Roth finally win the race?
I'm going to get into my Indy 500 mode right now, Bill. Nobody's really sure what's going on! Look, there are events about which I know a lot. There are events about which I know a little. The Indy 500 is a major event for not knowing anything at all. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to predict that Sam Hornish Jr. wins the race.
Excellent.
Although I hope A.J. Foyt the Fourth does, so people would have to say Foyt the Fourth a lot.
The NBA's conference finals stand at 2-0 in favor of the boring teams, or at least the teams that we know best. I think we're looking at a San Antonio-Detroit final. Am I being premature?
No, I think we are, too. I don't see Utah mustering up enough jump shots, to be perfectly honest with you, to make a series out of that. And the Cavaliers just aren't ready to play the way the Pistons insist on playing in the playoffs, which is to keep the score under 80 points. Now, as David Stern once again reaches for the bourbon bottle in NBA headquarters and realizes that he's going to have an Indiana State High School Championship score in all 7 games of the NBA Finals, we're going to wind up with a rather close but rather boring final series, I believe.
Charlie, speaking of NBA news, the outrage caused by Tuesday's draft lottery is just now dying down. What's the likelihood that the guy picked 5th in the draft will turn out to have the best career of anybody joining the league next season?
Well, I don't know who it's going to be, so I didn't know who the 3rd pick in the draft was going to be, let alone the 5th pick in the draft. The Celtics and the Grizzlies, and to a lesser extent, the Milwaukee Bucks, had really terrible days in the lottery. You know, anybody who thinks the lottery is fixed, though, when you consider that they're sending the 2 top players to the Western time zone where no one will see them play for the first 3 or 4 years of their career, has got some arguing to do.
Just days after he implored Major League Baseball to apologize for the steroids controversy, Jason Giambi met with league reps after the New York Daily News reported that he had tested positive for amphetamines last year. Good timing.
Yeah, this is another example of why any union that agrees to random drug testing should take any promises of privacy with a grain of salt. This was pretty plainly thrown out there, at least from my conspiratorial view, by Major League Baseball to blunt his continuing dialogue about steroids. Peter Gammons, among other people, argued that perhaps the amphetamine story isn't true at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's just another example of drugs making people crazy.
In feel-better baseball news, the Chicago Cubs will be putting a statue of Ernie Banks outside of Wrigley Field before opening day of the 2008 season. How can it be that there isn't already a statue of Ernie Banks outside of Wrigley Field?
I was completely floored by this. I'm telling you, though, if they really want to honor Ernie Banks, they got to put up 2.
I like it. Reversing the result of the 2005 Champions League
final, no!
AC Milan beat Liverpool 2-1 on Wednesday. I hope your few Bob were on AC Milan.
I had no Bob. I have no Bob, no Lira, no Deutschmarks or anything on this. I know that, even I know that their previous encounter for this trophy was one of the great either collapses or comebacks in the history
depending
of soccer,
on your depending, point of view,
on,
right.
depending on whether you eat linguine or shepherd's pie. But if I may take a try at the name, Filippo Inzaghi made sure that would not happen again. And now, is this one of those soccer trophies that they will start competing for again immediately, like this week?
Very shortly.
Okay, very good.
Is it fair to say that Qatar will be taking no chances regarding fan support when their soccer team plays in the Asian Cup in Hanoi, Charlie?
Wait a minute. See, I'm really upset with the Qataris. Okay, so I went and I spent 10 days watching soccer there back in the 90s. I was a really good infidel. I spent a lot of money over there. And now they're paying people to watch soccer, and I'm not one of them? I mean, this is the primary occupation of every Qatari is hiring enough Filipinos to do the real work. Why can't they hire me to go to Hanoi and be a soccer fan? I can root.
I love it, and I love
watch
the idea that...
away, 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 away. It's sand, all sand.
Could somebody check and see if hell is frozen over? Charlie Pierce just engaged in a soccer cheer.
Hey, for money, I'll do almost anything.
On the mascot front, PETA has urged LSU not to replace its recently deceased mascot with another live tiger. How do you think LSU will respond?
They will ignore it and go get another tiger. I wish they would do something better for Mike, though, than keep him in a cage where people can stand around. I mean, it is the last time I saw the previous Mike the Tiger, he was in a cage about the size of my half of my garage, and it really did nothing pretty much but pace, and it can't be good for animals like that. Build a habitat for them. You've got enough rich alumni and college men from LSU, Bill. You know,
you come in dumb, go out dumb too, and boy, will we get letters. Thank you, Randy.
I mean, one of them has made a lot of money. You haven't built a real habitat for the tiger.
Whatever else you might think of the state of bicycle racing, it's not short on melodrama or intriguing characters. The most recent example of the latter is one Dr. Wolfram Meyer Augustine. His testimony in the Floyd Landis case cleared up what exactly?
Well, it cleared up the fact that that scientists don't necessarily have to be boring. He's described in the AP Dispatch as a spike-haired, jeans-wearing expert with a pinky ring. This guy came in and decided that the doping procedures under which Floyd Landis have been penalized aren't worth the powder to blow them to hell. At the very least, this has been the least boring sports legal proceeding in the history of sports and law.
And finally, Charlie, is there any truth to the rumor that some of the members of the first-place Milwaukee Brewers are not only young, but dun-dun-dun, restless?
Yes, and somewhere in the baseball beyond, Harvey Keene reaches for the Galliano and mixes himself up another wall banger. Yes, your Milwaukee Brewers, your rampaging first place, I might add, Milwaukee Brewers, setting me up for the great karmic confrontation in my baseball soul in the World Series between Milwaukee and Boston, are going to appear on a soap opera.
Mm-hmm.
And while they may in fact play most of their games on at the edge of night, they will be appearing on The Young and the Restless. And the idea that I know the name of two soap operas is sad enough.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Dun Dun Dun. Only a game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Whether they put squirming live bait or meticulously hand-tied flies on the ends of their lines, anglers usually have one thing in common. They want to catch fish. But there's an angling club in the heart of San Francisco that boasts more than 500 members, yet has no fish on the premises, though it does offer a rich history and some of the best fly-casting instructors in the country. Only a Game's Karen Given visited the Golden Gate Angling and Casting Club, and she has our story.
Inside the Angler's Lodge, tucked away on the western end of Golden Gate Park and across the street from the Buffalo Paddock, a fire takes the chill out of a wet Saturday morning in April. Despite the rain, the lodge is bustling with men and a woman or two, many suited up in waders and carrying fishing rods. Mel Krieger is in the kitchen, fiddling with the sugar packets for his coffee.
I've been around a long time, you can tell from my age, yeah. And I teach fly fishing and fly casting here and all over the world.
Krieger is one of the club's celebrity members. You might recognize his name if you're the type to buy fly fishing books, videos, and DVDs, or if you've researched fly fishing clinics and international getaways. So if anyone's an expert on the Golden Gate Angling and Casting Club's status in the world of fly fishing, it's Krieger.
There are a lot of places where they have clubs, but this is probably the best facility in the world. There are people that come to San Francisco because they want to come and visit this incredible facility. Built by the WPA under Roosevelt. Fortunately, the politicians of those days may have been fly fishermen also, you know.
A love of fly fishing is not listed in FDR's official biography. But in 1938, when the lodge and casting ponds were built, skilled workers needed jobs. Under the Work Project Administration, or the WPA, some of the finest craftsmen of the era worked on the lodge. A stained glass window of a brightly colored fly decorates the front door, and fish-shaped motifs grace the shutters and the floors. Behind the lodge, Club Vice President Bob Porter stares at the beautifully landscaped grounds and crystal-clear casting ponds, while dog walkers, runners, and mothers pushing strollers pick their way in between the practicing casters. The GGACC might be known around the world for its facilities, champion casters, and host of experts on everything from fly tying to fishing photography, but Porter says closer to home, the club is a bit less famous.
People hiking through here all the time, and they just stop and go, wow. And people go for years without discovering this place. You know, they've hiked and run in Golden Gate Park, and they've never quite stumbled on this place, you know, and go, whoa, what's going on here? This is fabulous.
It's Porter's job to encourage visitors to check out the sport, maybe even join the club. But like all exclusive sporting organizations, not all who drop by meet the entry requirements.
Red-tailed hawk.
Oh, wow. Beautiful.
Throwing me up and landing in this pine tree. That's gorgeous.
Well, okay. As long as you're human, you'll probably get in. And you can probably afford it, too.
It is not expensive. It's $30 a year. Anybody can join. Anybody, you don't even need to be a member to use the facilities here. People join because they then get involved in lots of activities here. We have fish outs going on all the time. We have competitive events happening here. We have classes in different elements of fly fishing, from knots to fly tying to entomology. So there's a lot going on here all the time.
Many of the club's activities date back to the late 1800s, when it was known as the San Francisco Fly Casting Club. They held their first casting competition in 1939, soon after the new facilities were dedicated. Since then, the club has hosted too many tournaments to count, even though the casting pools hold no actual fish. But Porter says in fly fishing, fish aren't necessary to hold a competition.
Well, in fact, in the world of fly casting, a lot of people don't like the idea of fishing competitions. There's something about the world of fly fishing is not about catching fish. It's about the sport of doing it and being out there and enjoying it.
Fly casters compete for accuracy and distance. In the accuracy competitions, casters try to place the fly inside two concentric rings that look almost like hula hoops suspended in the water. Both of the club's casting pools have areas set up to test accuracy, and many of the world's best casters practice here in Golden Gate Park.
The club has just historically dominated the whole world of fly casting. So literally we've had the world record for fly casting was set by somebody from this club in 1899. And in the last 50 years, we have pretty much dominated the world of fly casting competitions in the United States and internationally. We have one member who has been national champion 32 times.
Wow.
And world champion 16 times, and they only hold it every 2 years. And he's still doing it.
That member is Steve Rajeff, who holds the U.S. record for two-handed fly casting at 295 feet. Although everyone says these casting pools are among the best in the world, it's hard to figure out where Rajeff practices such casts. They're longer than the pools at the club. Doesn't all that noise scare away the fish?
No, the noise doesn't transmit into the water.
Inside the lodge, one member shows me how to wind new line onto a reel, while others get equipment out of their tall, skinny rod lockers and chat about everything fishing-related. Rual Hariko tests out the feel of a Japanese bamboo rod. Hariko is a bamboo rod manufacturer. He also ties his own flies and teaches others the things he's learned. Not bad for a guy who grew up down the street, but never picked up a fly rod until he was older.
I promised myself when I was a child, I used to live off of Cabrillo on 33rd. And one day I rode my bike around here and just watched a whole bunch of the fly fishermen and told myself one day I'll be able to come out here and do this. And finally I did, and a gentleman by Joe Lum took me under his wings. I was just making a whole bunch of noise out here, and Joe couldn't take it. He came down and he goes, I can't take this anymore. Just go up to the club, sign the form, become a member, and I'll take you under my wings. And he just drilled me, and ever since I've just been hooked.
Yeah. Stop. Stop. Stop.
stop. Very nice cast. Those are great guys. Well done.
As the San Francisco fog rolls in, Jean Cecil, her husband, and son are getting a casting lesson. Compared to the champion casters who've been practicing all morning, the Cecils look like rank amateurs. But they're not bad, given the fact that Jean's only held a fly rod once before, when she and her husband took a guide-led trip for salmon.
That was a great cast. Do you see that? It's rolling over nicely. It's going to present the leader and fly fish for
the fly first. Wait till those little salmon see me.
Oh, they won't. They won't stand a chance. They'll shake in their boots at the sound of your name.
The Cecils came from San Jose today to try out the rod Jean got for Christmas. They're not members, and they don't know anyone here. But that didn't stop instructor Willie George from lending a helping hand.
He was over there earlier casting, and my son Ben and I were watching him, and I said, I know just enough to know when I see a good cast. And then he put his things away and came over, and he's giving us a free lesson.
Wait, you mean this isn't prearranged?
Oh, no.
You're not paying?
No. No.
Willie George gives free casting lessons at the club on the second Saturday of every month. Today is not the second Saturday, but the fact that the lesson is free and spontaneous doesn't diminish the value.
We saw my improvement, you know, stop. It's a hoot. He obviously loves his sport.
It might seem strange to spend a morning casting a line into water that has never and will never hold fish, but Bob Porter says practicing the sport without too many expectations can be a lesson well learned.
You can approach it from both the very intense aspect of fly fishing to where you're going for catching fish moment to moment, or it can be the most relaxing experience going, being out on a beautiful river. The art of fly casting itself is wonderful and phenomenal and relaxing. And if you're not intent on catching fish that day, you can have a phenomenal time.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in San Francisco.
None of thy fly. Dance, trout, dance. Hear the call of the double haul. Shoot to the fire pool. A subtle drop from an eastern sky. Dance, trout, dance. Honor thy fly.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Ben Singer, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view Karen Given's fly casting photo gallery, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Golden Gate Angling and Casting Club member Rual Harico, who ponders what his life would be like if he hadn't joined the club.
I mean, I would probably be doing something else, maybe become a pro golfer.
Yeah, but would he go about golf the same way he approaches fly casting? That is to say, if a fish were to jump out of a water hazard and land in his golf bag, would he release it? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
It's a cascade of life and death. The pulse quickens as the trout plot thickens. Mend your line, mend your ways to the river's flow.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFoundation.org.